All right, let's get to work, folks.
You're a little more conversant.
Everybody? Dan's here.
On the unlikely event that we get out of here, are you available?
Yes, please.
Okay. Let's come back to order, please. Welcome to the afternoon session of the City Council for December 3rd. Would you call the roll, please, Carla?
Novick?
Here.
Fritz?
Here.
Fish?
Here.
Saltzman?
Here.
Hales?
Here. And would you read item 1253?
Are we going to take care of that first item, 1247?
Oh, sorry. Right. Yes. No, sorry. Let's set that over to the end.
To the end? Okay. 1253, transmit report to the City of Portland on Portland Police Bureau officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths by the Office of Independent Review.
Okay. Auditor Griffin Villade.
Afternoon.
Welcome. If you're going to use, there you go.
Yeah.
You know how that works.
Good afternoon. LaVon Griffin Villade, Portland City Auditor. This probably truly is my last time before this body in this capacity. But you never know. OIR Group's report presented to Council today is the 8th outside review of officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths. City code requires a review of all closed officer-involved shootings and in-custody death investigations. The reviews are a snapshot of the Bureau's policy and procedures during the incidents and investigations examined. These reports have provided the city the benefit of the expertise of subject matter experts who have many years of experience in civilian oversight of these types of critical events. Since the first report completed by the Police Assessment Resource Center in 2003, there have been significant advancements in how the Police Bureau conducts officer-involved shooting in-custody death investigations. Some of the key findings of that first report were there was not a consistent commitment to meaningful review, which resulted in lessons not being learned from incidents. In 31 of the 32 cases examined in that first report, there was no internal administrative review at all. There was not a sufficient emphasis at the policy and tactical level of issues involved in officer-involved shooting and in-custody death cases. So some of the key PARC recommendations that have been implemented by the Bureau, the Portland Police Bureau changed the officer-involved shooting in-custody death investigations from a homicide-only model to one that includes a broader review, which includes a robust administrative investigation as well. They made the change to review process so that all the officer-involved shootings and in-custody deaths are reviewed and include an outside civilian and bureau experts on what was first known as the use of force review boards and eventually became the police review boards. Also, Portland Police Bureau revised policies regarding officers shooting at moving vehicles. So the unresolved recommendation from that first 2003 report from PARC, all involved witness officers are subject to an internal affairs compelled interview no later than a few hours after an incident. Outside reviews are ultimately a mechanism for community members and City Council to have more timely and transparent access to information about such important critical events. To that end, cases are now eligible for review at the close of the administrative investigation instead of at the end of civil litigation. In the past, that contributed to long delays of many years before reviews by an outside expert were conducted, and which also then created a backlog of cases to be reviewed. OIR has now completed 4 reviews, including the review of the Portland Police Bureau's investigations of the death of James Chassie, which was the subject of a standalone review issued in 2010. Some recurring themes have been delays in interviewing involved officers after an incident. This implicates the 48-hour rule. Delays in the administrative investigation and case review process, with most cases taking over 15 months to be reviewed, and also post-incident medical care of subjects. These outside reviews played an important role in the 2010 and 2013 IPR code changes, particularly the creation of the current police review board and having the IPR director or his designee as a voting member of that board. So by way of introduction to the team from the OIR group, I'd like to begin with Mike Giannacco. Mike has a law degree from Stanford University. He's a founding member and chief attorney of the OIR group. Prior to the creation of OIR, Mike served for 6 years as a U.S. attorney, Central California, chief of the Civil Rights Division. Prior to that, Mike was a federal prosecutor for 8 years for the U.S. Department of Justice, the Civil Rights Division. Julie Rulin has a law degree from USC Law. Prior to joining the OIR group, Julie worked for the Police Resource Assessment Center. And prior to that, Julie was a criminal defense and civil rights attorney. Finally, the third member of the team, Rob Miller, has a law degree from UCLA Law. Prior to becoming the deputy chief attorney of the OIR group, Rob served for 15 years as a criminal prosecutor in the LA County District Attorney's Office. Since 2001, the OIR group has contracted with the Los Angeles County Sheriff's Department to review high-profile officer-involved shootings, inmate murders in county jails, and scores of less-than-lethal force incidents on patrol, in jails, and in courts. Other jurisdictions they have provided such services to include San Diego, Oakland, Pasadena, Torrance, Palo Alto, and the Denver Sheriff's Office. So I'm going to turn it over to Mike at this point.
Okay, thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Giannacco.
Good afternoon, Mr. Mayor. How are you today?
Thanks for being here. Appreciate your team and the good work they've done to do this review. Thank you.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to supplement our report with a few comments. I have to say that, as the auditor indicated, this is our fourth report. Our third report that focuses on shootings and in-custody deaths. In this report, we review 8 additional officer-involved shootings and 1 in-custody death. As a result of our review, we also offer 21 recommendations to the Bureau for its consideration. There is nothing more potentially controversial in police work than a time in which an officer feels the need to use deadly force. And when that occurs, there's always going to be a potential for controversy with regard to those incidents. The public has a right to know what transpired with regard to the officer's decision to use deadly force and how the department investigated that incident, as well as a right to know, in my view, the level of review that was conducted internally by the agency, by the police agency. Obviously, presenting the case to the district attorney and presenting before a grand jury, which is done in this city, is another important element. But as the park folks said in the initial report, it shouldn't stop there. There needs to be an examination of the officer's conduct, both with regard to the decision to use deadly force and other decisions that may have led to the ultimate decision to use deadly force. In addition, any effective outside independent review or internal review should also focus on other events with regard to post-care, with regard to post-incident response, and with regard to the integrity of the investigation itself. Unless that is done, police departments will be in a position where the incident itself will not become a learning experience, and the fate will be that there will be more likely additional officer-involved shooting if, in fact, there is no learning back to the department, if there is no accountability back to the department with regard to performance that did not meet the expectations of the police bureau in this case. And unfortunately, in this country, just to put this in context, the majority of jurisdictions, the majority of police departments in the state of Oregon, state of California, and throughout this country do not have the level of review that the Bureau has. And most of those jurisdictions also do not have any outside forces, any outside inspection of the processes that go on both with regard to the investigation and with the review. We are one small part of that. This council is aware, of course, of IPR and the work that is done there with regard to the Citizens Review Commission and some additional jurisdiction that's coming as a result of the settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. So this city is differently positioned than the majority of other cities in dealing with this issue. Fortunately for this city, because there has been a tradition of review as a result in large part of the Park Report, there now is a process by which the department takes a look at decision-making that goes beyond the decision to use deadly force, that examines the lead-up decisions that are made by officers, and is critical of them, both with regard to the potential for accountability, but also with regard to the potential for training, both at a micro and a macro level. At a micro level, I'm talking about bringing information back to the individual officers, any sergeants on scene, as part of a learning experience. At the macro level, I'm talking about bringing any lessons learned back to the Bureau as a whole through training, through exposure to the incident in a constructive way. When we review, when we do our work, our review is necessarily impacted by the work that the Bureau has done. And what we attempt to do is to examine the internal investigation that is conducted by the Bureau and the review process to make sure that the Bureau takes advantage of these incidents in a constructive way in order to better prepare its officers for future challenges and hopefully reduce the likelihood of the need to use deadly force in the future. As I indicated in my opening remarks, we have 21 recommendations. We're not going to go over all of them today, but are prepared to answer any questions that the commissioners and the mayor may have. But we do want to highlight a few of them. The first recommendation that I think is worth emphasis has to do with the length of time it takes in order for the investigative and review process to unwind. And I'm turning that over to my colleague, Julie Rulin, for further reflection on that.
Hi. Yeah, this has become...
And could you refer to by number as well in your 21?
This is recommendation number 19. Okay. Goes to one specific piece of this. The delays in the Bureau's review process has become a sort of theme over our last reports. We have a table on page 98 that shows the length of time into the from the incident to the review board hearing. We also have, when we discuss each individual case throughout this report, a timeline of the investigation and review process. With few exceptions, all of these have taken longer than a year, and I don't think anyone is in disagreement that this is just too long. It's too long for the Bureau, that needs to be able to learn from these events, to hold its officers accountable, but also to identify issues that go to how to improve their training, how to improve if there are equipment issues that are raised by the incident, or any other corrective action that may come out of it. It's too long for the public, who wants and I think deserves some resolution to these incidents. And it's too long for the involved officers, who I think deserve to not have these incidents and the Bureau's deliberations hanging over their heads for such a long time. The Bureau has a number of steps in its review process, and we have often in our reports praised the rigor with which the Bureau goes about reviewing these incidents. There's a training analysis that's done. There is then a commander's review, and then there's time it takes to schedule it for the review board. In general, we have not found that the investigations themselves take they're done relatively quickly, with exceptions. I'm not going to go through individual, but often when there is a lengthy investigation, there's often a reason behind that. But the review process itself needs some streamlining. And one of the things that we have recommended in order to try to prevent, I think, this sort of cases getting bogged down in this process is to take another look at that commander's memorandum and to see whether that could be eliminated, modified in some way to try to shorten this. There's sometimes just a little too much process, and you can't get through the review when you have so many different layers. So, we have discussed this with the chief. We've discussed it with the commander of the Professional Standards Division. We know that the Bureau is thinking about new ways to sort of trim these timelines, and we look forward to continuing to look at this issue as we go forward in our reviews and also working with the Bureau as they try to work on it and develop some new ideas.
Good. Thank you.
Another recommendation that we think is deserving of attention with regard to our comments this afternoon has to do with an investigative matter. And it has to do with recommendation number 3, Mr. Mayor and Commissioners. And traditionally, the Bureau has worked together with the East County Major Crimes Team, which is a team of other agency detectives in investigating officer-involved shootings that occur in the east side of the county. What we have seen, unfortunately, is that because these detectives do not seem to have the level of training with regard to the way in which they question witnesses, particularly police bureau witnesses, that it calls into question the way in which the interviews are conducted, in particularly the use of leading questions in which the answer is suggested to the officer during the interview is something that does not pass muster on Investigations 101, but we unfortunately continue to see that come forward when the detective from the other agency begins to ask questions of the officer.
Could you elaborate? I'm a little...
Yes.
So you're saying when our own officers are conducting the investigation, there's the questions are leading?
No, it's when we're using folks from the East County team, which is Gresham and Troutdale and Multnomah County sheriffs. Right?
That's right. It's not the Bureau officers, but the Bureau officers are often teamed with another agency.
Okay.
And so the Bureau officer often takes the lead, sometimes not, though, but often takes the lead in the interview. But at the end, questions will be asked like, well, weren't you in fear for your life, officer, when X occurred? Which it really isn't the officer giving a statement. It's the questioner giving a statement and the officer affirming the question. And that technique is just not consistent with best investigative practices. We think one of two things need to happen, and that is either to increase the level of training for these outside agencies so they understand and have some sort of monitoring of their performance so that we don't continue to see this consequence happening over and over again, or for the Bureau to do it on its own. There is some advantage in having an outside group be involved in the process. I think it really could help serve the integrity of investigations outside the city, for example, if it happens in Gresham and a Gresham detective has figured out how to ask questions appropriately. And I don't mean to single out Gresham, that's a hypothetical. But one of those two things, in our view, needs to happen. Otherwise, we're going to continue to find cases in which we're not sure whether it's the police officer that's making the statement or whether the statement has been provided or fed to him by a leading question. So that, I think, is an important investigative reform that we would like to see the Bureau consider. The third issue, and maybe one of the most important ones, has to do with outcomes. And as we indicate, this is recommendation number 18. With regard to outcomes, what we have seen is that at the very end of the process, there is a review board that meets. The review board is diverse. It contains people who are not with the Bureau, and it contains IPR. We find that over the years, that review board process has been fairly robust. But coming out at the very end of the tailpipe, what we have seen with regard at least to the shootings in this report is while the decision and recommendation is made as to whether or not the board felt and recommends to the chief as to whether or not the shooting is in policy or not in policy, that a lot of other questions and remedial measures do not come out of the process that we think could come out of the process and, in our view, should come out of the process. Two things in particular. One is, as I said in my opening remarks, oftentimes there are tactical issues that are engaged in by the officer that are either consistent with the expectations of the Bureau and consistent with the training they've received, or unfortunately in some cases not consistent with the training and not up to the level of expectations of the Bureau with regard to performance. When it's the latter, our experience has been that those performance issues can often put an officer in a position where he or she feels the need to use deadly force. So we feel that that examination needs to be more robust, that every review board should be asking themselves that very question. That should be part of the scripted responsibility, if you will, of the review board to look at those decisions. Not to say that the board wouldn't find that those tactical decisions in some cases were consistent with the expectations and up to performance levels or not, but we think that question should be asked as part of the routine of every review board, and that is another one of our recommendations. The second part of that is if, in fact, the finding by the review board is that the expectations were not up to par, not up to expectations, then in my view, our view, the review board then should work with the Bureau to develop a remedial plan, a corrective action, a way in which the performance of these officers can be brought up to standard. It doesn't necessarily going to require discipline. Sometimes it might, depending on how far below performance expectations we have found. But something ought to be done, and there needs to be a better feedback loop with regard to that. I'm now going to turn over another recommendation discussion to Robert Miller, to my right.
Thank you, Mike. Thank you, Mr. Mayor and commissioners. We appreciate this opportunity. I'm going to be addressing recommendations 8 and 9, which appear on page 46. In a way, these recommendations also concern corrective action and get at a very special characteristic of the Portland Police Bureau and the city process, which involves a great deal of self-examination and valuable feedback loops, but we have found some crucial gaps, at least in this particular area. Our recommendation is that when a Portland Police Bureau officer is involved in a shooting, that if there are previous shootings in which that officer was involved, that the review board, in the normal course of its evaluation and analysis process, consider the facts, circumstances, and any lessons learned from that previous incident or previous incidents, and any patterns or suggestions of potential corrective action that might emerge from that sort of cross-incident analysis. The opportunity, because of the procedures that are used in the review board and the way information flows, is extremely rare, if ever, that the review board would have that opportunity. And I think this is a missed opportunity for the Bureau itself. In the shootings that we have considered in this report and the previous two reports, at least two of those incidents involved officers who were involved in the shooting and who also had previous incidents. I want to be clear that our recommendation is not to stigmatize or make any assumptions about an officer involved in more than one shooting. In fact, in some of the jurisdictions we're familiar with, that's not even an unusual circumstance. Fortunately, it is an unusual circumstance in Portland. The point is feedback loops, really. That's one of the primary objectives of your very involved and concerted procedure for analyzing critical incidents in the Portland Police Bureau. And the purpose of these feedback loops is to provide constructive information and suggest possible remedial actions. And as my colleague explained, remedial action, corrective action, is viewed, at least by us, very broadly to include changes in policy, changes in procedure, training, as well as discipline. But it really goes beyond discipline and should be defined as such, because it's not necessarily just about the individual officer. It's about the Bureau as a self-improving learning organization. In the normal course of currently, as we are as has been explained to us by the Bureau, and as we have observed, when the review board considers a critical incident, they consider it isolated from many other incidents, and only if they decide there has been an error in tactics or judgment that reaches the level of requiring corrective action, does the Bureau then reveal to the review board that, in fact, there was a previous incident or shooting. We think that puts the cart before the horse, in effect, and that it deprives the Bureau of this feedback loop or the full constructive nature of it from what is really a rather unique entity, and that is your review board, which includes not only members of the Bureau, but members of the community, representatives of the police rank and file, IPR representatives, et cetera. The precise procedure that would allow for a careful, objective, and fair consideration of an officer's behavior in an individual incident, yet involve, yet allow the review board to consider the length and breadth of the tactical issues at hand and how they might relate to future improvement of the Bureau itself, those specifics we certainly must and do leave to the Bureau and to the review board itself. But there, we have seen many models, and we believe there are certainly adequate available ways to incorporate those considerations into the current structure. I'm now turning consideration back to my colleague to the right, Julie Rulin.
Another recommendation that we make is in recommendation number 16, and it has to do with officers' response to individuals or arrestees who are in some sort of medical distress. And this recommendation comes from our review of the in-custody death of Mr. Darris Johnson in July 2011. In that case, there was a foot pursuit involving Mr. Johnson, and when he was eventually apprehended and taken into custody, he made the claim repeatedly that he was having trouble breathing, that he couldn't breathe. And officers disregarded these claims. There's reasons for doing so varied a little bit between their belief that he seemed fine, that he was talking and acting normally and was able to walk, or that he was still just out of breath as a result of the chase. And so they didn't. They essentially believed that he may have been making these claims about shortness of breath and difficulty breathing as a way to avoid or delay going to jail. So rather than call for an emergency medical response team, they made the decision to transport him to jail in their patrol car. On the way to jail, Mr. Johnson became unresponsive. Paramedics, they called paramedics at that point, and he died a couple hours later at the hospital. They found, when they did the autopsy, they found methamphetamine in his system, and they found that he had had an enlarged heart. He essentially suffered a heart attack, and it's not, we can't know whether earlier medical intervention might have prevented this in any way. Regardless of that, the recommendation is that we make is to require officers to, before transporting a subject who claims to have difficulty breathing, to seek to call EMS and to get him some medical treatment, at least get an assessment by EMS before making that transport. The current directive are pretty good. It's pretty good dealing with this issue, and those directives were rewritten following the death of James Chassie in 2006. And the directive currently says that officers will not transport without EMS clearance if the subject displays any difficulty breathing or any kind of other medical distress. But we just think this policy needs to be tweaked a little bit so that it's not based on the officer's discretion about what symptoms appear, but it's based more on the subject's claims about being in medical distress or being unable to breathe. And we think the Bureau has agreed with this. They've agreed with this recommendation, and we're hopeful that they will quickly move to make that change to this directive.
I have a question about that case, and looking at page 85, and it says when this was after they realized that Mr. Johnson had become unresponsive, and it says they got out to check on Mr. Johnson, whom they found unresponsive and without a pulse. They called for paramedics and a sergeant, pulled Mr. Johnson out of the car, and put Mr. Johnson on his side in an attempt to position him to ease his breathing. And it wasn't until the sergeant arrived and instructed them to begin CPR that they did. Is there no policy that says if somebody has no pulse that we start CPR immediately?
I think in that case there was a question about whether CPR was appropriate, whether he was breathing some, and whether there was
no pulse.
Yeah. I will say, Commissioner, that the record on that was not entirely clear as to how events transpired. I know the sergeant arrived quickly and was there, and things were moving very quickly.
Mayor, I'd like some more information on that part of the policy.
Okay.
I assume that all of our officers have some measure of emergency medical training, CPR at the minimum. I'm just finding that part of the report astonishing, and then there's no particular recommendation that you made in response to that piece, which is of great concern to me.
Yeah, your recommendation is about consulting EMS response.
Yeah, and I totally agree with that. If the person says they're having difficulty breathing, then you call EMS. You don't make that assessment, especially since they're obviously not. The officers who responded didn't know to do CPR when there isn't a pulse. So I agree with your recommendation and just questioning the rest of the policy and whether medical attention to people in custody policies are adequate.
Okay. Well, when we get the Bureau, we'll have the Bureau up here to respond in general, but we can ask them about that particular question while they're here.
Okay.
The final point that, substantive point that we'd like to make has to do with not a defined recommendation, but a recommendation we've made in the past that, again, appears in these reports. And it has to do with what is called as the 48-hour rule, and the discussion about that in this report appears on pages 65 and 66. In the city of Portland, as a result of a labor agreement between the city and the Police Bureau's association, officers are not required to provide any statements about an officer-involved shooting or an in-custody death until at least 48 hours after the incident. And as a result of that rule, it is 2 days before the Bureau learns anything from the major actor in an officer-involved shooting, a use of deadly force, until 2 days later. That approach and that restriction on communicating with officers and finding out what happened is inconsistent with normal investigative practices. When you have a major incident, one of the first things that detectives on scene do is ask witnesses, is ask actors, is ask officers, is ask anybody who might have information about the incident about what occurred. But that can't happen in this city because of this restriction. So what happens is if we have an officer-involved shooting on Monday, it's going to be Wednesday before the Bureau learns from the officer about what transpired. In our view, that is not, as I said, not consistent with investigative practices, and I think has the likelihood of impacting not only the integrity of the investigation, but the public's confidence in the investigation. When I'm talking about the integrity, what I mean is that for 2 days, the officer is out there, and either consciously or subconsciously, his recollection of events could be impacted by outside and external influences. If the incident receives a lot of media attention, and many of them do, he or she may just hear on the radio, on the television, inadvertently or advertently, about what has transpired. And that may impact the officer's recollection when it finally comes time on that Wednesday to ask the officer what happened. So in our view, the 48-hour rule ought to be done away with. And as with many other jurisdictions, the officer the night of the incident ought to be asked, tell us what happened. Where were you standing? Why did you use deadly force? Talk to us about the lead up to the use of deadly force so that that information can be provided. The other disadvantage in waiting for 2 days is with any investigation, any investigative leads often are built off of the major actors to any incident. If you wait 2 days, you can't use the officer's statement to develop investigative leads the night of the incident. And as any detective would know, investigations are like uranium. They have half-lives. The most important time to collect information about an incident, to search for witnesses, to get information, to develop forensic evidence, is the night of the incident, not 2 days later. So for all those reasons, we advocate, again, that the city and the Bureau reconsider this agreement that they've had with the association about the 48-hour rule. In closing, that sort of sums up our substantive remarks. I would be neglectful if in our closing remarks, obviously here to answer any questions that the mayor, Mr. Mayor, the commissioners might have about any other aspect of our report. But we do have to, I feel, an obligation to indicate that, again, as with our three previous reports, we have received nothing but cooperation, nothing but access, nothing but interaction with the Bureau command staff with regard to information. We can't do these kinds of reports unless we have the information. I'm not just talking about documents. I'm talking about discussions. I'm talking about insight that the Bureau, tactical experts and other experts do provide us on a regular basis. And finally, our work is only as good as the support that we have received over the years from your other external oversight entities, in particular the IPR and the auditor. We've received nothing but unwavering support for our cause, and insight into our findings would not be as deep, would not be anywhere near as insightful, but for the participation and the working relationship we've developed with your city auditor and the IPR that works for her. So for that, we're very grateful. And thank you for taking the time to hear us out today. Thank you.
Thank you. I'm sure there are questions, but I just want to say at the outset, we really appreciate this work, Auditor, and to the whole OIR team. It's really important that we get objective outside views of what we do right, what we do wrong, and how do we get better. And that's the spirit of this work. I'm glad to hear that the Bureau's been cooperative in giving you all the information you needed. That's what we would expect, and I'm happy to hear that expectation's been met. But I think this is really important, that we have this kind of open, public, professional, objective review of what our practices are in the Bureau and what went right and what went wrong in past incidents. And I, as the police commissioner, I got to tell you, I find this extraordinarily helpful. I've read your report. I'm going to reread your report.
the Bureau is going to be given a chance here today to respond to each of those 21 recommendations, and obviously I'll be hearing from them on that subject as well. But I think it's really, really healthy and useful part of our process here in the city, and I want to thank you.
Thank you.
So, Mayor, my understanding is you just said that the police are going to respond to the 21 recommendations.
Yes.
They've already done so. Do you have any response to their response, or what's the order of that?
Well, I was assuming we would give Assistant Chief Henderson and Professional Standards Division Captain Famous a chance to come up and talk, but we can do that before or after they
Maybe
respond.
We could have this team back. Are you going to be standing for the testimony?
I think it would be useful, you know, to hear from both sides of that conversation here in the council chambers. So that's Donna and Dave, does that sound all right to you? Well, I was going to, okay, but sorry to surprise you with that. I was going to ask you to come up and spend a few minutes on the recommendations where you had disagreement. Because obviously there's 21 recommendations here. There are some where the Bureau has responded, and the response is public, of course. Agree, we've changed practice, here's what we're doing now. There are others where there are works in progress, and there are others where they agree in part or disagree in part or in whole with what you've recommended. I think those are important debates for us to have, and don't want to have that go on endlessly here in the council chambers, because there are a lot of other people that want to speak as well. But I think it would be useful to hear from both you and them about the, I think there were five or six of the 21 items where the Bureau either disagreed or disagreed in part with your recommendation. So I thought it would be useful, Chief, Assistant Chief Henderson, and Captain Famous, to have that discussion here in the chambers one way or another. We'll start with you since you're here, since you no point in being coy about this. It's written down which ones they disagree with. So if you might want to spend a couple extra minutes on those, you know, they took an opposite position, for example, on item number 3, which is the one about we've already discussed about the East County Major Crimes Team. And I think their position was just it's good to have outside eyes on the work. To me, it seems like there might be a middle ground here, which would be highly qualified outside eyes. But I'm jumping, cutting to the chase a bit. But what's your reaction to that? I mean, where is there a middle ground, or do we just need to take it or leave it?
Mayor, I think the middle ground is as you articulated, which is one way to thread this needle, in my view, is to find a way to ensure that the capacity or the ability or the training, I think it may be a training issue, of these outside detectives is consistent or up to par with the Bureau's detectives. And so if there could be more training in a group setting where the skills of the Bureau's detectives can be transferred over to other agencies, not only would it help with regard to the integrity of the Bureau's investigations, it would help with the outside agency's investigations as well. So it would be a regional advantage to do that. Yes.
Yeah, and we're certainly finding that, particularly in East Precinct, we're working together with those other agencies all the time anyway. So,
correct.
Another one that, again, I was going to ask for them to elaborate a little bit on is number 8. You've already discussed that. They've agreed to review but disagree on at least some of the proposed changes.
I think we understand the Bureau's position, and that is, they don't use this metaphor, but it's similar to typical criminal procedure where the guilty or not guilty decision is made, and then only after that is the sentencing decision made. And sentencing, lots of kinds of things are admissible that would not be admissible in the main trial. I think the administrative investigations and administrative corrective action is really a very different system, and therefore the siloing off of information from the jury, as it were, is the stakes are much different, and the public policy, the other benefits of having the review board be privy to previous incidents and determine for themselves whether there are any patterns or similarities or whether there are dots to connect that might point to a change in procedure, a change in department policy that they might recommend, that that is a potential benefit that is lost by siloing things off this way.
Mm-hmm. Good. One you didn't highlight earlier, but that is an area where there's a disagreement, was number 11,
yes,
where you said that the Bureau should inquire of the medical examiner about the survivability potential of a down subject who's not provided immediate medical attention. Obviously, this is a terrible situation when it's occurring. You've said consult with a medical examiner right away. Is this person, in danger of dying? What can we, what are your options medically? I think that's what you were positing, and they're saying, well, I'll let them say what they're saying. But elaborate a bit on that one, if you could, please.
Yes, Mayor Hales. One of the issues that continues to come up in these historical cases, and I have to indicate that, we're still talking about cases in 2011, so we're still a little behind what's currently going on. And I think as a result, there have been some reforms with regard to this issue. But the real issue has to do with something I indicated in my opening remarks, which is post-medical treatment to downed individuals, people who have been shot by Bureau officers. In two of the cases that we reviewed in this report, this very report, it took 84 minutes before any kind of medical attention was provided to the individuals who had been shot. Now, there are reasons for that. Every case is different. But we have commented in the past about the need to re-examine the Bureau's response and see whether or not, without sacrificing officer safety, there's a way to get to these individuals and get them medical attention sooner rather than later. As a corollary to that, we thought it was also important that when the investigation itself is being reviewed, that the medical examiner, as part of the detective's investigation, be asked the question, the simple question, look, you've examined the bullet wounds of this individual who died, it was a fatal case, during the autopsy. Can you give us any insight as to whether, if the Bureau had been able to get there earlier, this individual might have been able to survive his injuries? That question isn't volunteered by the medical examiner. It also hasn't been traditionally asked by the detectives. We think that question should be asked so that the Bureau has that knowledge. I don't want to speak for the Bureau, but the Bureau indicates that that may be a speculative question, and then the ME may not be able to answer that question, which is fine. But it doesn't hurt to ask the question, in our view. So,
even absent any change in procedure, you could ask the question.
That's right, sir.
Okay. Yes. And the only other one I wanted to highlight, again, in terms of asking them to elaborate, but you as well, number 15, about canine standard operating procedures. There's a disagreement there between you and the Bureau. Talk a little bit more about that one, please.
Yeah, sure. The Bureau's response has to do with their guard and bark standard. And so the assertion is that, if the canine is being deployed just to guard and bark and locate a suspect, that's a very useful tool for locating even misdemeanor suspects. Our view is that, this was not a dog bite case. Mr. Johnson had, the dog never caught up to him. He jumped a fence and the dog was called back. And so the use of the canine in this case is a little bit of a side issue, but we thought it was important to raise it because this was a subject who was wanted for a very minor misdemeanor. They were going to arrest him on supplying a false identification to a police officer. He was originally going to be cited for a seatbelt violation. When he fled, the canine officer on scene released the dog with a command to catch the suspect and bite him. And in our view, a dog bite is a very significant use of force. Dogs can inflict very serious injuries. We have not had the opportunity, because it just has not come up in these cases, we have not looked at dog bite cases. I don't know at what the bite ratios are for Portland Police canine units. I don't have a good sense of how big an issue this is, but it raised a red flag for us here to see a dog released with a command to bite a subject who was wanted for such a minor offense. And so the recommendation is made for the Bureau to consider this and consider whether that's an appropriate use of its canines.
Okay. Thank you. That helps. I appreciate that. Other questions for the panel? Great. We may have more later on. And again, I might want to go ahead and, if the council is interested, have Assistant Chief Henderson and Captain Famous come up now and answer some questions, and then we'll go through the rest of the public hearing.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
No, I didn't. I just assumed it was in there.
Charlie, what number is the 40?
That is, I think it's 13. No, nope, maybe you're wrong. I'll ask them. Thanks for coming up. So, again, I don't necessarily need you to go through all 21. You already have, and you've provided a written response to the report, but I did want to focus on a couple of these. Maybe not so much number three. It sounds like we've already got a potential solution there, or unless you want to elaborate on that in terms of this question about divergent levels of training and qualification between our officers and the ones that we're cooperating with.
We're in constant training, and we discuss...
And just identify yourself, Donna. Sorry.
Oh, I'm sorry. This is Donna Henderson, Assistant Chief of the Portland Police Bureau in Investigations. We do ongoing training as we're participating in these investigations, and I think the level of investigations by the East County Major Team is getting better, and we're constantly observing it. So we agree in part, and we're doing what we can to bring that up. But I feel strongly that we still need to have them involved in our investigations, just for the transparency.
Okay. Another one that I wanted to get you to respond. Do this in order. The medical examiner issue, about whether the medical examiner should be consulted about the survivability potential of a downed suspect. Again, obviously a terrible situation when it's occurring. We have ballistic shields now in every sergeant's car, so I think we're probably getting to people much more quickly. Is that the case?
That is very true.
Yeah.
Would you like me to?
Yeah, I'm going to let you answer.
Okay. I'm George Burke, commander of the detective division, and I agree with our ability to ask the question. That what is difficult for us is to be able to get the answer. So whether it's supposition on the part of the medical examiner, we certainly can ask. I do know that one of the things that we are provided at every post-mortem examination is is what rounds or what injuries look to be lethal versus non-lethal at the time of the post-mortem. So we do get that information in kind of a different direction, but we don't ask the specific question of if medical attention could have been provided sooner, would this wound have been survivable? We simply get is this a survivable wound or not? And I will say that, as we said previously, the Police Bureau has done a lot with bringing in new technologies, new techniques, new training, and the shields has been a significant implementation. And then oftentimes, tactically, trying to make decisions that really would potentially make the encounter more survivable for the downed suspect. We really need to keep in mind that we don't want to precipitate an additional shooting after we've already been involved in the use of deadly force. So there are a lot of different situations that come into play as to how and why and when we can make an approach to a downed suspect to include any proximity of weapons. So there are a whole lot of different factors that come into play when we're trying to analyze getting medical attention and how long that takes, and will we make the problem worse by getting somebody, you know, trying to make that approach.
Yeah.
Let me just clarify, though. We're talking about the medical examiner after death, right?
We're
not talking about the physician
during,
who's called up on
incident.
The scene.
Yeah.
We're talking about afterwards.
No, but we're asking, the question is being asked in regard to, would medical attention, if it had been provided sooner, would that have changed the outcome?
And what is your objection to that question being asked?
I don't have an objection to it. What I'm saying is that we can ask the question. We certainly are going to get whatever response we get. What we do have is we get an answer from the medical examiner on every postmortem that deals with each and every injury to the person in the postmortem, and that determines, and that statement is given as to whether that was a lethal injury or non-lethal injury.
In the report, it says that you disagree about asking that question.
Well, what we're saying is that it is up to the medical examiner to make that determination as to what they're going to respond. We we can ask the question. So I think it's something that we need to take a look at. We need to be able to be open to ask the question. The concern that we have with this is we're asking somebody to make a decision or make a subjective decision or opinion based on the outcome rather than all the other circumstances that led up to it. But asking the question, I don't see why we couldn't ask that question.
I think in that context, I think I'm following. It's a medical question.
Well, this is it gets to a bigger question. Is I would like this question to be asked.
Right.
So in terms of our discussion today, how does that direction get given?
Yeah, well, that's my job, and I think that question should be asked. And I think we have to make sure that we understand it's a medical question being asked of the medical examiner. It's independent of whatever tactical considerations
there
were.
They're not asking should the officer have gone in.
Right.
They're saying, was this survivable if we had gotten there quicker?
Right. So I
can tell you from personal experience that it can be very helpful in two ways. One, for the family of the person who's died to know that, no, in fact, even if we'd have gotten there within 2 seconds, that wouldn't have made any difference. And second of all, I think in terms of the city's liability, it's helpful for us to know and for the family to know that in fact there was no negligence or there wasn't an opportunity to save the life. So for both of those reasons, I think it's very important for us to always ask that question of the medical examiner.
Yeah, I think it's information we should get, even though it doesn't answer all the other questions, it does answer that one.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay.
That's understood, thank you.
Thank you. And then the other one I wanted to ask you about was the canine one, which we just discussed last, and that was our standing procedures about deployment of canines. How have they changed? Since these cases occurred, what other light would you throw on this? And I guess again, what's your disagreement with the reviewers here?
Well, number one, I'd have to go back and read it better. I'm not as familiar with this case because I don't think we ever send a dog to bite. I think we send. I don't think that we do that. And if we did, I'd have to go back and see why we did, because that's not how our canine operates. We tell them to go get them, and I'm not even sure what the exact order is, but it's not to bite.
Well, there are situations where we tell a canine to bite, right? I mean,
according to this report, it says not. That the police response says, while many agencies train a fine and bite standard, The Portland Police Bureau's canine unit has trained and deploys to the guard and bark standard.
Now, that doesn't mean that a dog, given the violent nature of the suspect, won't bite, but we don't train them to go and bite automatically. And it kind of...
Right. Hey, please, let her talk. Go ahead.
So I don't think that the sergeant actually opened up the door and told the canine to go seek and bite. I don't think that's how we train.
But the bite command is given by the officer in a situation where they're with the dog, right? I mean, I've seen that done, and it happened with Officer Dorn and Mick, and the dog got killed, and Officer Dorn got wounded, and you know that story.
The concern was that the dog was released at all, given that a
dog
could get excited with one bite, and that wasn't appropriate.
I think that is something that I don't think when we're talking to canine that we were willing to say that we would never send a dog out after somebody for misdemeanors. But in this case, what you're talking about, that it was such a low level, failed for seatbelt, I think that is something that we could look at. Is that appropriate to send a dog after something so low level?
That's where I'm not understanding. All they're asking is to not use canines for subjects suspected of committing serious or violent felonies, and our responses disagree.
Right, because we would send a dog after misdemeanors. We don't want to give up that option.
Why?
Because we would end up having to search for these people no matter what. We're not going to just say, okay, you ran, and let them go. So it's safer for the person that we're going after, and it's safer for the officers to actually have the dog do the search and try to locate this person. It doesn't mean that the dog is actually going to bite. And so to take that away, that means anybody that we remotely think that was just a misdemeanor, we would have to send officers into the field to look for them. And I think it's safer for everybody to have that option of sending a dog after somebody, even if it's a misdemeanor. Again, back to the seatbelt, I'm not so sure that was appropriate. But to take away the option of sending a dog after all misdemeanors, I don't think we would. We don't think that would be a good idea.
Could you give me an example of a misdemeanor? Because I'm not familiar with all the things that are classified as misdemeanors. Some would think that it would be crucial that the suspect be
apprehended. Domestic violence for assault.
That's a misdemeanor.
It could be a misdemeanor, and if the perpetrator took off into the blocks, that might be something we would want to have.